Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Jennifer Cohen. Now, Jennifer is co-managing director of POBA, P-O-B-A, a nonprofit initiative of the James Kirk Bernard Foundation. POBA celebrates, protects, and promotes creative legacies in all forms of artistic expression. Among other things, POBA keeps alive the work of artists who have died without full recognition of the measure of their talents and creative legacies by showcasing, promoting, and preserving their creative work. Welcome to the show, Jen. Can you please take a minute just to tell us in your own words a little bit more about POBA and how POBA really works?
Hello, Daniel. Thank you for having me today. Certainly very excited about having this opportunity to talk a little bit about POBA, because I think it's such a special project and one that working artists and families of artists really will find as an important resource. When we launched in July of 2014, it was initially to showcase the art, the photography, the video, the choreography, artists who had passed before necessarily they had received the full measure of recognition that they deserved during their lifetimes, and also to offer these families of these artists unlimited storage online, so that we were creating really the first virtual art center for the public to come and explore the exceptional of underrecognized artists. As we developed over time, we really saw the increasing need for both living artists and for estates to get some of the services that are so badly needed by artists. Cataloging, archiving, tips on how to preserve their work for posterity, how to digitally store them, how to give directions as to how their works should be treated after they pass, but also to help them understand that one's creative legacy is something that artists of all types of media have to start really at the beginning of their careers. They have to act as parents to their own creative work. So through POBA, they can not only get tips as to how to preserve these works, but also access to a number of partners who can provide very important tools for living artists, as well as appraisal, archival, and restoration services.
Well, thanks, Jennifer, for that summary. I want to ask you, now, POBA focuses heavily on artistic legacies, but what is an artistic legacy? You know, does every artist have one regardless of their discipline?
Well, I think absolutely, and it's not only professional artists, but, you know, the great amateurs in the arts are very important to have their works preserved. The creative legacy is, you know, it's not necessarily an issue of resume, or how many shows you had, or how many albums that were recorded, or how many performances you mounted. But rather, there's something more central, which is the creative spirit itself, which is shown through those works. And that's what we're trying to showcase and keep alive and promote at POBA. What is the actual core of the creative intent, and what remains when, you know, the artist has passed on?
So what are some of the challenges to working with visual artists as opposed to musicians?
Well, I think the challenges for all artists are pretty much the same. It's about basically how to protect their works, and that is the physical protection of the works as they're created, whether they're affixed to canvas or to drawing paper or to analog or digital tape, but also the preservation of copyrights, of their rights themselves. Not only the rights to make copies, protect their intellectual property, but also, which is a very important emerging field, to talk about what their intent for their work was. That sometimes an artist, a visual artist, might want things displayed in a certain way, especially a performance artist that has visual elements in their work. Having a documented sense of what the artistic intent was is part of protecting the legacy, as well as copyright, as well as how does one physically store things, how does one physically display things so that they can really be preserved for all time, and also how to catalog them and archive them so they're protected from natural disasters. I mean, I think one of the things that those of us who live on the East Coast saw after Sandy was, you know, how many great artists' works were just, those collections were lost because they weren't stored properly.
Well, and I personally know artists who are in coastal towns all along the Jersey Shore. And, of course, the wind damage and flooding wreaked havoc on their studios. And saving those works became of the utmost priority at that time. If you were out of town or, you know, out of the country or left it in the hands of your family, it was a serious challenge, even if that wasn't true. So Jen, what is different about POBA from other arts organizations? I mean, the Clark Hewlings Fund is an organization too. How does POBA sort of stand out?
Well, happily, we discovered the Clark Hewlings Foundation and working with them because we think the work that they're doing is very important and well aligned with what POBA is doing. POBA was created really to be not only an online display center, but also as a resource hub. Many artists, all forms, don't know exactly where to turn for all the resources that are needed. We at POBA don't profess to have in-house expertise on every issue that would be of importance to visual artists or to artists in other fields. But what we do want to provide all artists and to the estates of those artists and their families is a trusted resource center that can help them find the best possible resources, whether those are toolkits that may be developed by people such as the Volunteer Lawyers Association, whether they're actual tips or living experts in various fields. When you need to find someone who can archive or photograph your work or appraise it, or when, unfortunately, something does happen through smoke or water or a light damage, you can find out who to go to and who you can trust. And hopefully, POBA can not only source those people and those resources for you, but we also, through our concierge service, kind of oversee all of that work. So we become your partner if you're an artist or an estate, and help you go through all those services. So we think that's a rather unique approach, that we are here as a 360 service to artists and their families. And that's also why we've begun to work not only with important organizations like the Clark Hewlings Foundation and the Joan Mitchell Foundation and many others, but why we also are partnering with the state arts councils as part of our tip of the hat to the extraordinary work of the NEA over the last 50 years.
So I get it. It's not that POBA fulfills every needed service for the artist. The fulfillment is often taken care of by partner organizations, but it's a clearinghouse for helping people connect with those organizations and sort of find the services they need. So, for instance, with the Clark Hewlings Fund, of course, we equip artists with tools and education and introductions to sort of further them down the path of a particular career. So we'd be a natural sort of referral partner for POBA. But then let me ask you, with regard to working artists, when should artists start managing their artistic legacy? I mean, immediately, right now, while they're creating their next great work? And if that's so, how do they do it? What's the checklist, the bullet list of things they need to be doing?
Right. Well, that's a very important and big question. And I think I'd like for a moment just to put this into historic context a little bit, because some of the work that we're now asking our artists to do, the institutions that used to support them and were designed to market their work, no longer do that work. And so we're putting a tremendous demand on artists, not only to create their art, but also to manage and market it. And that's why I think organizations such as Clark Hewlings and POBA are becoming increasingly important, because you need more than a clearinghouse. You need actually some caring organizations that can take you through the entire process. But with regard to when is the right time for an artist to start thinking about their legacy, I think we have to demystify the term legacy. That's always associated with, some great and famous, man or woman's work, or it's ascribed to things that one thinks about at the late stage of one's career as you're trying to think about what to do with your life's work and who should handle it and who should manage it. I really like to think of creative legacies as something that starts really with the first moment that an artist, amateur or professional, begins to feel the calling and create the work. Because they really, in addition to actually creating the work, they have to take this role now because of what's happened in institutions that used to support them. They have to take the role really that they're parents to their own works. So with regard to specific and easy tasks that they can undertake, they should be cataloging their work. When it's created, the medium that it's created, they should be making sure that the dimensions are properly defined and just keep a running list on that. They should be having a duplicate list put in another site. If they're making just a kind of a handwritten list, there should be a duplicate with somebody else off-site, off of the studio. If it's in a digital format, they should make sure that it's in a stable digital format, and there should be a redundant catalog. They should be taking pictures of their work. Most importantly, they should be informed about how to store unsold work during their life. And on POVA, and I'm sure on the Clark Holding site, there are already tips available as to how to protect it from variations in humidity and from light, some of the basics that all artists should be aware of. And one of the things that people don't often think about is keeping a real list of where their works are shown, what the prices were at the time of the first sale, if they're lucky enough to have had sales, and if they can keep ongoing lists of where these works wind up, what collectors have them, that becomes very important down the line. But to photograph the works before they're leaving the studio, to date them, and to have a complete catalog, that's really one of the most important things. And of course, any contracts that have been entered into, you should be sure to keep those contracts and to have, it's very useful to have critical dates put in a notebook or put in your computer that signal you when a contract with a, for instance, a gallery might be coming up for renewal or certain rights might be reverting. This is especially important with the Copyright Reversion Act of 76. All artists, not only music artists, but visual artists as well, have a right to recapture their underlying copyrights, even if they had licensed them away.
Wow, Jen, you're really singing our song here. And of course, you know, the Clark Hulings Fund provides a tool called Artwork Archive that does most of what you've just described. It lets you have the pictures uploaded, track who those works are with, what the status is of them at any given time. And we provide that at a discount for our listeners and free for a year for our grant finalists. And of course, that information is at clarkhulingsfund.org/artwork-archive. Because it's called Artwork Archive. Now, just a reminder to our audience, the Clark Hulings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Jen, you mentioned collectors briefly, and I want to actually turn my question toward that and ask you, apart from appraisals and inventorying pieces, is there anything else at a granular level that collectors can do to protect the legacy of the artist's works they have collected?
Well, that's a very interesting question. For us, the focus in our work with collectors has been mostly focused on the actual physical archiving of the work and keeping records of the dates of acquisition and of the original creation of the work and the appraisal and the proper storage and display of the work. I think, you know, many of the issues that collectors are facing are very similar to those that artists are facing. You know, how to preserve it through time, when to display it, where to display it, and how to preserve it. I think one of the other issues that collectors have is to make their wishes known about how to dispose of collections if they're not giving them as directed gifts to members of their family. There are some very tricky, complex issues involved with the donation of artwork to museums these days, and that require different types of appraisals and different types of arrangements. And as you may know, even those that want to donate work, finding a place to take these works sometimes takes additional money is being put aside for the care of these works and for them to be incorporated into existing collections. This is something that's really changed in the last generation, where donating works become actually a little bit more difficult than they had in the past.
I think those are excellent points, and we just did an interview with a collector and sort of had that discussion about whether or not there's a duty of care for the works that one collects, and his answer was very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. I think that's a very important point, and it also impacts a little bit on the whole legal area of VAR rights. I don't know if you discuss that with the collector.
We do. We do frequently discuss that with collectors and other. I don't know if we discussed it with that particular one, but that show is, of course, on our podcast page. Now you make me want to go back and ask another question. But so give me your insights on that, Jen.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. We did a presentation, you know, for the New Jersey Council of the Arts, and we were talking about this in front of about 130 artists a few months ago. And many of these artists didn't realize, and this is also important for collectors, they didn't realize that they had ongoing rights as to how things that were publicly displayed could be continued. For instance, if an artwork that has been damaged in some way, whether it continued to be displayed, how it could be displayed, all of these things really become partnerships between a serious collector and a serious artist, that the collector, you know, has a certain, I would say, this is my personal opinion, a fiduciary role to be respectful of the artist's intent.
Yeah, and I think the collectors that we talk to would applaud everything that you're saying. So collectors, if you haven't been listening to this series, Jen Cohen is one of the reasons why you should, because that's you're singing their song, Jen. I really like that. Let me ask you about a third constituency. So we talked about working artists and how and when they should start protecting their legacy or managing their legacy. We've talked a little bit about collectors. So, but now I want to ask you about heirs. So specifically, you know, at CHF, we believe that collectors have a responsibility to show and protect the work in their possession. But what happens after a collector is gone? What should the heirs to the collection do with the pieces? And we know that that's pretty common, you know, that these days the children of collectors are inheriting and they may or may not have the same original intent as the collector that purchased the work. So if they're listening, what should they be thinking about in terms of what to do with the pieces they have to preserve the legacy and so on?
I think we can expand that audience a little bit, because it's not only the heirs of collectors, but it's the heirs of artists themselves, who often, even though they're the children of the artist, they don't necessarily have the same commitment or even understanding of the work that their parents were generating or that their loved ones are generating, in much the same way as inheritors of collections aren't sure to the importance of the collection. I think the same challenges exist for both cohorts. In the case of collectors, as well as children of artists, there are some issues with regard to not only preserving the work itself, but preserving the work's value. And while someone inheriting a collection may understand that there's emotional value attached because this is something that their parents either created or collected, there's also the financial value itself. And this is something that has to be taken into account when they decide how they're going to dispose of these items if they don't feel like holding on to them themselves. I mean, we've often heard, you know, the story of a person who inherits a collection and really doesn't have interest in a particular area and winds up basically bulk selling or even offering it to a charity to auction off all at one time. And without understanding that even though their intentions might be good to make these items available for even charitable purposes, what it does is it can actually harm the artist and deflate the value of the works that they're trying to sell and to give to charities to raise money on. So that's one issue, is how do you dispose of things and how do you avoid deflating the actual prices of the collections themselves? The other is getting things properly appraised. And there are all different sorts of appraisals that are involved, whether it's going to be for insurance purposes or inheritance purposes, fair market value. These are things that a collector should be aware of and an artist's heir should be aware of as well before they go in and wholesale appraise a collection. But probably the most important thing is how the collection, if it's not being maintained in private hands, it's going to be stored, how to protect it physically. Things that you would do, you know, for visual art aren't the same things one should be doing when you're inheriting other types of collectibles or items. So you have to really educate yourself as to how to protect art from dust, from humidity, from light, from all these things that will degrade not only its value, but its look over time.
So I will expand that. I think that's good. The notion of heirs of collectors and heirs of artists as being one group. So let's tie that group together and ask you a question. So would you give different advice to heirs, whether of artists or collectors, to get the ball rolling with establishing the artistic legacy of their loved ones or the artist they love while the artist is still alive, or B, sort of recently after their death, or C, long after the death? Is it a different process, or is it roughly the same process to establish that legacy?
Each situation is very distinct, and that's why, you know, with POBA, we actually felt it was very important to offer personalized concierge assistance to help kind of intake every situation. There are some artists who are meticulous about keeping files and records and have stored things properly for years. They might even be associated with a gallery. They have contracts. They have an artist mission statement all ready to go. And so it becomes a much easier situation to handle. There's sometimes photography of all the work itself, and there's a complete catalog. We have other situations where we call it close the barn door syndrome, where an artist has been previously working. You know, we have one artist who had a 60-year career, and when she passed away, you know, at age 92, literally the door was closed on two barns full of work that had not been photographed, had not been cataloged, had not been stored in any particular way, and this obviously created, you know, an enormous challenge. And so the first step is always finding out from the artist's family or even from the collector's family, what is your goal? You know, is there an issue of wanting to publish a book featuring the collection? That'll determine the type of photography that needs to be done. What are the aims of the heirs with regard to disposing of the collection? Do they want to donate various items to museums? Do they want to arrange for resale? And then the questions have to come back and forth about, you know, if one is going to sell, where should one sell? Does one go through auction houses, through old galleries that have been associated with the artist, through private collectors? These are all things that should be discussed, you know, on an individualized basis. I don't know if I'm really helping in saying that there is no particular one answer. There are things that every artist and every collector needs to have. The catalog is key to that. Documentation is key to that. Provenance, all these things, very important. But how one approaches it really comes down to a very personal conversation that needs to be had with the heirs themselves. Sometimes the emotional attachment is what's guiding the conversation and the resources that need to be identified. And sometimes it's more practical, financial consideration that is. But, you know, one of the interesting things, if an artist hasn't really been actively involved with planning all of the aspects of their legacy for after they're gone during their entire life, one thing that's very helpful for both artists and collectors alike is to establish a trust into which these artworks go, and then have a friend who is aware or a colleague who's aware of the importance of the individual pieces or intent or why you put together this collection or created a particular series in visual arts, and have that person be your trustee. Because then you have somebody who's not only dealing with things from a legal standpoint, but has an informed sense of what the individual items in the collection mean.
No, I think that really is helpful. And, you know, it's something that the Clark Hewlings estate, of course, deals with when it comes to the paintings of Clark Hewlings. We are always dealing with somebody that wants to establish provenance, or, you know, it helps a lot if you start early. It's sort of a similar message. I just want to pause and give a shout out to someone really integral to this show, and that's Natalie Baumgartner, our producer. Now, she tirelessly does the legwork that produces this show, nurtures our guests through the process, and makes me look as stellar as I can possibly manage to pull off. Thank you, Natalie. From all of us here at the Clark Hewlings Fund and the Thriving Artist Podcast, we really appreciate you. So, Jen, back to you. I want to ask you, what if an artist never sold any works or never built up a documented following in the first place? So what do their family and friends do then? Is that a disqualifier from creating an effective legacy?
Not at all. And I think, you know, that's really a key thing to underscore here. You know, creativity and commercial success are not necessarily things that travel on the same lane. If we were to restrict ourselves only to artists who had tremendous success during their lifetime, you know, in many fields of creative endeavor would be that much poorer. I mean, you know, was Wallace Stevens a poet, or was he an insurance salesman? I think certain things become revealed only over time. But whether the work ever finds a commercial market or not, it's still, we believe, at POBA, the creative legacy itself is worth preserving. Sometimes it can't be done in a physical way because of constraints with storage, degradation of photographs or of drawings over time, prints. So that's one of the reasons why we offer the unlimited storage that we do to all of our presenter members at POBA, so that there is a place where these things can be stored digitally and shared amongst colleagues, potentially as galleries, representatives, and ease the burden that individual heirs of artists might have. But, you know, the great amateur is a very important part of our artistic scene. I mean, amateur comes from the whole nature of the lover of. And, you know, I think we've discovered over time some great people. And, I mean, look at Vivian Meyer. Was she a nanny or was she one of great photographers of this last period? There was just recently a documentary on HBO about a woman who's actually predated the first printmakers of the whole Provincetown scene, the Provincetown colony, Hans Hoffman, who was unknown because her works were stored in a large trunk and left to be discovered by her great niece, who happened to be a filmmaker and then did this HBO documentary. You know, you never know when the work will be discovered, and especially, as I said earlier, in a world where artists are having to do much more of their own legwork, I think we're going to see increasingly very talented and interesting artists not necessarily having kind of tangible commercial careers throughout their life. I mean, I think the NEA said in 2010 that there were over 2 million working artists in the United States, and I think we only have 80,000 galleries. So that'll give you an indication of how many are really not having their work displayed, not because the work isn't good enough or shouldn't be shown or shouldn't have a market, but because there just isn't that infrastructure to help develop and display it.
Well, let me ask you sort of a balance question, and this is about oversaturation, Jen. So someone on a recent show said there's probably too much art being created. Mm-hmm. And so my question is this, is quality of work an issue? How do you evaluate whether an artist's work actually deserves to be in the canon or have a substantive legacy in the first place?
Well, you know, that's the question of who is you, right? That is making that determination. I think obviously over time, things rise and things are discovered that had been left to the side. Other things that remote, you know, as Andy Warhol would say, you know, that had their moments in greatness really are revealed over time to be, you know, in my opinion, some certain things that were very famous really become relegated more to a position of craft than art. I would disagree with your guest who said that too much art. There's a difference between the creative impulse and the art market. And I think, that might be the distinguishing issue. At POBA, we're trying to encourage, creative legacies to be broadly defined and to see their value as beyond, just the commercial side of things. But yes, there is a lot out there that doesn't necessarily stand the test of time.
Well, let me ask it another way, too, then. I'm still going to take another run at you. So let's say if you survey parents in America, all American babies are intelligent and all are beautiful. But of course, that isn't really true in our experience. So what about art? What happens if someone brings artwork forward that is arguably not very good, but they still believe that the talent or contribution of their deceased loved one is important? What do you do then?
Are you talking about what does POBA do, or what should the family do? I'm not sure.
Well, let's tackle both. What should happen, and what does POBA do about it?
Well, in the case of POBA, we've been very fortunate because we actually have a range of artists in terms of level of success in all the different arts, but most of it is really interesting. There's a basic level of creative capacity and ability that we do. Take a look at things from that level. We also find, you know, Pogo were not necessarily totally focused on the resume of the artist as much as the creative intent and the importance of the creative effort that was made. For instance, we have an artist who I particularly loved. She was an artist who had never painted before she became blind and was in a wheelchair. And yet, in that state, she had these creative visions. And she had a friend who she would bring in to help give her the colors that she would ask for. And in her mind's eye, literally, would see things that she would then translate to canvas. So in that case, for us at POBA, that was a story of someone to whom creative impulse was so strong that it really defined a whole period in their life and a way of having creativity overcome adversity in a very extraordinary way. And so, you know, her works are welcomed on POBA. We also, you know, have works that have stood the test of time but have gotten less recognized as the artists, you know, have passed away. For instance, the work of Ben Zion. Although he was known in later life for his Judaic work, he was originally a member of the Ten with Laszlo and Gottlieb. And that work has been somewhat lost in time because he moved away from the mainstream market. But the work is there, and that's what Pogo is about, is to be able to display it. I mean, yes, there is the art that should, you know, best remain within the family notebooks. That has its role in people's lives, the creative impulse, but it doesn't necessarily exist as, you know, how would one say it, art qua art, which I think has to be capable of independent life as, an independent thing. Each canvas has to live in the world separate from its creator at a certain point.
Well, I really like that concept of, you know, the art needing to be capable of independent life. So, for instance, you know, the Clark Healings Fund, we have a grant review panel that's made up of artists. And so it is artists who are judging the art business proposals of our grant recipients and finalists, etc. And, you know, they don't agree on genre. We have people that are really into representational art, such as realism, people that are into conceptual art, such as abstract art, people that are into installation art and other formats. And so they go back and forth, you know, I love it, I hate it, etc. But it's for us, it's not really about the genre. What they come down to is they may say, none of us agree on whether to love it or hate it. I hate it, but I acknowledge that this work is professional art. It meets some subjective criteria that means that I respect it as the work of a professional artist. It is viable as professional art. And what's more, the business plan, the business proposal that this artist put forward to take their career to the next level, that's viable. And so those things generate the result that they become finalists. So the question I have for you, Jen, is about genre. Is it harder to establish a legacy for some genres or some media formats of art than others? And so, for example, what if it's mainly photos of installation work, now long gone? Or what if the style of art is a style of art that just is no longer in vogue? There's very little demand. Is that more challenging to establish a legacy?
Well, I think those are two separate paths, and each present some interesting challenges. I agree with you, and I understand the process with Clark Collins is very similar in certain ways to how Pogo would look at it, although we're not obviously looking at, you know, the business plans for artists. But, you know, there is the integrity of artistic intent, right? That is a key thing. The second one is, of course, technique. Those two things together, I think, help us all define whether we think a work is of certain artistic quality, whether we like it or not, whether it resonates with us or not. So assuming that those two things are there, in the case of, you know, different fields of art, when you're dealing with installation art or you're dealing where you might only have photographs or performance art, part of the problem is, yes, you know, how is it being documented? And this is also goes into this whole area of VOCA, which Glenn Wharton down at NYU has been looking at quite a bit. And this is around what is the artistic intent at the time, and how do we, as people who are committed to preserving legacies, help fulfill that intent through time? In other words, if someone is doing an installation, are there enough notes about that installation so we know that the artist intended for it to be viewed in a certain type of light? Or was it intended to interact with a certain exterior, with the environment in a certain way? All of that becomes very important, and that is hard to maintain and sustain for the artist. The same thing as we're moving through different formats, right? Sometimes artists would, especially in performance and installation art, you know, there's a tendency for us all to use whatever is the latest technology. But in some cases, maintaining an analog approach and not digitizing becomes key to the artistic intent. So that whole area of documenting what your intent was is very important. So installation work, I think, is its own special category, and it is hard to preserve. But in other fields, no. I mean, I think the technology now exists, which didn't exist at the beginning of my professional career, to replicate and store art quite faithfully. That helpful? Was that too long-winded an answer for you?
Not at all. I think you're spot on. I like the answer. I think what you're talking about is, I mean, I can't help but relate it to sort of fashion. You know, men's fashion changes dramatically. This year, everyone's telling me to wear shorter sleeves and skinnier ties, and I won't do it. I grew up wearing timeless fashions that lasted 20 years, and I buy my ties from the 70s and 80s online, you know, Gucci and stuff that I really like that has never gone out of style, and I'm committed to that. So what I tell people is when they say, you know, oh, you should buy skinny ties, I'm like, well, next year you'll be saying buy fat ties, but the ties that I buy will always work. There'll always be a market for them. And I think sometimes with art, it just comes in out of vogue and comes back into vogue. You know, I mean, you're not going to go wrong preserving a legacy for an abstract expressionist because that's out of vogue. So I love the answer.
I think it's also very important to say that just because something was valid in a particular period of time does not mean that its artistic value has degraded because the circumstances have changed. I mean, using fashion as a continuing, you know, parallel, we have on POBA the work of Patrick Kelly, who was a black fashion designer who wound up living in Paris and designing there before he passed away from AIDS. And the Philadelphia Museum of Art just did a display of his work last year, and people were very excited to have it. But you look at the videos of his runway work, and you know, you can see that this is very much in the 80s, in the style of the 80s. But the work is extraordinary, down to, you know, the construction of the buttons, to the lines that were being done, to the actual visual art that's affixed to the pieces. So just because it references a moment in time does not make it any less important. I mean, I think, you know, there's this quote of the still point in the turning world. That is what art is at its best. And we can't confuse what art is versus what art is worth in a commercial market. Now, as someone who's trying through POBA and in partnership with Clark Collins and other organizations to help artists have careers, obviously we have to balance both of those things. But the art exists with its own value as a kind of living entity.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I'm a film aficionado, and when I look at something like The Shining, you know, Kubrick's film, and I think about the references that were from that time period that are sort of no longer applicable. I mean, no one's carrying around a cell phone in The Shining. And some of the things that are popular at the time, you know, the landline rings, you know, who has one of those anymore? But, you know, the thing is, they're talking about, they're remaking, or they have remade The Shining, and I couldn't care less. I can't imagine anyone being Jack but Jack. I just don't see it as outdated. I don't think it happens that way.
Well, that's, you know, the difference also, again, between art and craft. Art is the first time you do it. Craft is all the replications and updates and refurbishings afterward.
Oh, that's a great point. Craft is the imitation or the remake in some ways. But, you know, I think collectors, the ones that I've talked to, are not driven primarily by tastemakers and the winds of fashion anyway. If they were, they wouldn't collect old things. So, frankly, I think what you're saying is going to really resonate with our audience. I want to ask you about an apparent catch-22, though. So is there a catch-22 where the reason that a deceased artist's work is obscure is not that it's bad work, but it's in the hands of someone who doesn't even know enough to reach out to get help? You know, it's sitting in a garage, they don't know what to do, and it sits there year after year. How do you find that audience? How do you reach, say, a widow who has her late husband's paintings in an attic but has no idea what to do with these things?
There's a process, because it's not an easily, you know, as we would say in marketing, it's not a self-identifying market. You can't, you know, put an ad and say, here we are, we're available to help. So, you know, it's through podcasts and through other publicity that we hope to get this word out that, you know, there is a difference between when you begin to look at a loved one's work. First stage is the emotional attachment to the work. And, of course, at that point, you know, one sees it and, you know, it's like the baby. It's the most beautiful. It's the most intelligent. There's the emotional attachment and the understanding, the lack of separation between the actual object and the loved one. And then with a little bit of time, those things separate. And I think if one is honest with oneself in looking at the work after, you know, mourning has passed a bit more, they can distinguish between what's an emotional attachment to the object as kind of a replacement for the loved one, and what is an attachment to the work itself because it has value, it has integrity, creative integrity, it has merit. And, you know, if the answer is yes, it does, I love this piece, I love this work, I understand this work, then, you know, that's when POBA, you know, is the place, you know, our doors are open to help through that process. But reaching those people is tough. And, you know, what we found, you know, we've been very lucky, having been written up in the New York Times a couple of times in our first year. We get calls from folks and they say, you know, I've had this collection and I didn't know what to do about it. So that's why, you know, for us, this is a process of getting out the word that these resources do exist. You know, in the case of Vivian Meyer, it was one person who discovered the work and basically advanced that work into the world. But often, you know, the person who is left with the work doesn't have the perspective, the wherewithal, or the energy to do the work of marketing and sorting through things.
Well, so there you have it. If you discover out in your garage a 1969 Mustang with 2,000 miles on it, you call me. If you discover out there some obscure and little-known works of Chuck Connelly or Cy Twombly or Ian Fairweather, you call POBA. They know what to do with it from there. And I want to ask you in this segment, as we wind down this segment and go into the latter part of our show, I want to ask you about provenance. So how detailed are you, Jen, in researching the origin and the chain of ownership of a work? And has anyone ever brought forward a stolen artwork? You know, I think eventually if you deal with enough work, sooner or later you're going to come across something that the provenance is dubious or at least questionable.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we are, you know, as I said, we've not hit our second anniversary yet. And the issue of authentication has really just come up in the last few months. And it's become increasingly active. It's quite funny. Something just happened today that I'll briefly tell you about. But we also were approached just about a month ago from a producer on a TV show that we had worked with because someone they knew had inherited from their father what they were told and what had been appraised as previously uncatalogued watercolors by Turner. And how, you know, how could these be authenticated? And, of course, the first step is being able to authenticate provenance, which is, you know, depending on the artist, is sometimes easy, and the collector sometimes easy, and sometimes more difficult. And then, of course, once provenance is determined, there are secondary and tertiary steps that involve more intense analysis of the actual style work, of the paper, the chemistries, that become increasingly detailed and increasingly expensive as you move towards getting authentication. So it's, you take one step at a time in a situation like that. Of course, you know, if you have a foundation or the artist estate has its own organization, sometimes you're very lucky in being able to get the authentication directly from them. Otherwise, There are some specialists in the area that we work with. We try and basically structure it for the individual cases. But the funny story I was about to tell you was that just today I was actually having to do a bit of a TV moment for POBA, and the person who was doing my makeup turned out to have potentially a very valuable piece of art that was given to her by the artist directly in the 1980s before he passed away. I'll leave the name unknown for a moment. And she's been having trouble getting it authenticated. And, you know, having been with the artist, known the artist, having other items of the artist, you would think this would be a real trouble. But now, just because this was a chance meeting, we're going to be moving to the next steps to establish provenance and to go from there so that she can have an ability. As she says, I now have two sons in college, and I'd like some help with putting them through it. So, you know, at POBA, this should be a kind of interesting story. It's a journey we're just embarking on.
That's fantastic. As we go into the last part of the show, I've got two areas I want to really ask you about. We've covered legacy at some length, and I want to kind of go into the topic of the digital physical divide and also of copyright. But first, if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Visit clarkhulingsfund.org/thrive to continue bringing content like this to the public. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Jen, POBA acts as a resource primarily in the digital space, but much of the cataloging or appraisal process has to occur in person. So how do you overcome the digital versus physical divide?
Well, we're actually both. Digital is the point of entry and the point of display, POBA, but we actually do physical concierge work across the entire country. So, for instance, one project we did involved the family of an artist who lived in Sonoma. The mother had died. She had a collection of painting that needed to be cataloged and prepared for storage and photographed, and we sent specialists there in the area. And because we're a not-for-profit, we were able to arrange very preferable rates for the family. We did an appraisal for the family, for those items that they wanted to sell, to give them a sense of what the value would be for a market sale. And then 6 months later, we worked with them to actually donate part of the collection, which had been part of an important traveling exhibition that had gone to a number of museums. We were worked with them to do the donation appraisal to a particular museum at Berkeley. So we had that situation there. We're actually flying someone, an intern from Minnesota to Oregon, to catalog an entire collection of tribal art that an ambassador to various countries had collected during her foreign service. And now that she's returned to her farm in Oregon, she needed to have a sense of the value of what she had collected over the years, what was worth having a formal appraisal on and help in creating a catalog, and then to start sorting out what she was going to donate to museums and what she was going to sell, what she was going to give to friends. And so we arranged for that. And we basically put teams on the ground anywhere in the United States.
So let's talk about the visual display of art at POBA. So can't people just put up a gallery on Pinterest or list whatever they have on one of the online art markets? How does POBA differ from something like Etsy or ArtNet or Artsy or something like that?
Well, I can't speak about, you know, other opportunities as much as what's unique about POBA. It's a curated collection. When you come to visit the site, you'll see we have a very particular, and I'm very fond of the look and the voice of the site itself. It's very intelligent. It gives context to the artist's work and to their life's work. The portfolios are put together in a very, I think, interesting way by our team that actually does the work and creates the written material. But we also at POBA offer complete social media support and traditional PR support for artists that merit it who come to the site. And so that becomes part of a package, part of our commitment to continue to not only preserve, but also highlight and promote the creative legacies. And we've been, you know, very fortunate to have the works covered really extensively and everything, as I said, from the New York Times and USA Today to Fox's Strange Inheritance to NPR. to various PBS programs. So we work actively with the families to help promote the work, and then also to help figure out how they can best sell the work, if that's what their goal is, or to find partners to help them with the actual promotion and marketing.
Okay, now, what kinds of interactions are possible through POBA? So give me an example. Let's say I've got my father's art up on POBA Select, for instance. Is it just on display, or are you connecting artists or art lovers in some way through the site?
Well, there are many different ways that we connect with the artists and with the public. So, yes, if your father was an artist and you wanted to have a display, you could put all of his work in the vault so that that's password coded, so that you could invite gallerists or other people to come and take a look at individual items that you otherwise would have to be emailing and sending. This is a central repository for an entire collection. Then there are portfolios that can be added to and changed. Each person is a presenter member and have an unlimited number of presentations. So that's the kind of the display and storage end of things. But where the real connection between POBA and the artists and the heirs and the public comes is through our concierge services. So in addition to giving tips and toolkits to artists as we can and offering blog information and referrals to partners, we actually have a live concierge team that all you need to do is fill out a little form saying what you're looking for help in, and you'll get a call from somebody who will then take you through the whole process. And we had actually the sister of Jean Spatz, a very well-known photographer from the 70s and 80s, basically putting her hands up in the air and saying, you know, I have 15,000 slides and I don't know what to do with them. And so this is a long-term process. We will, you know, work with this family to decide what's worth keeping, what's worth digitizing, what can be sold, how best to sell it, and how best to promote it.
Great. So, you know, obviously our missions, POBA and Clark Hewlings Fund, overlap, but they're also largely distinct. So where do you think the opportunities are for us to collaborate?
Well, you know, I'm thrilled that I not only found the Clark Hewlings Foundation, but that Elizabeth Hewlings and I have been talking about working together in many different ways. For instance, we have discrete audiences at this point, and so the tools that we make available, hopefully those can be used by some of the artists and audience for the Clark Hewlings Foundation. But also, we look forward to featuring blogs and materials from Clark Hewlings itself about how artists can be more involved and responsible as caretakers to their own careers. We are happy to be distributing that information through POBA and through our association with the State Arts Councils. We also are going to, I believe, act as a kind of outsourced concierge service for Clark Hewlings Foundation. So we're available to special arrangements with Clark Hewlings Foundation to give concierge services to the Collectors Society and others that help support Clark Hewlings, because we believe that the work you're doing is essential to growing a healthy, you know, artistic ecosystem where the best and the brightest can flourish because they're informed with business. So I think there's going to be a lot of ways we're going to work together, and I think this is going to evolve over time. There is a lot of work to be done, and there are a lot of good people doing it. And our goal at POBA is to help identify those, to refer to those organizations, the artists and the estates that need them.
Well, we are very excited about the partnership here at the Clark Hewlings Fund. So I want to shift gears to the final segment of our show where we ask you about copyright. So I'm not quite sure how I'm going to phrase this question, but I'm going to give it my best shot. So essentially, what role does POBA play, if any, in addressing and enforcing copyright? So for example, an estate has ownership of all reproduction rights to an original artwork. But given both the lack of a rights management system and a permission system or infrastructure for most art owners, most art collectors, and the potential in digital mediums, especially the internet, for easily downloading digital images and sort of doing with them what one pleases, what does POBA do about this? How does it address this need to enforce one's copyright in terms of the digital reproductions?
Well, you know, this is an area that I had to face early on in my first career in the music industry. you know, there are great advantages to the world of digital and great perils, especially for the artists in whatever medium they're in. So there are a few issues here. Number one, I mean, at COVA itself, because we are doing digital displays, we're very careful to display them in ways that would not allow for easy downloading and duplication. When we do social media watermark, when we display on site, we make it really very difficult for these things to be blown up in any way. And that's an important consideration when, you know, one is considering the quality of art that they're putting online. It's important to remember that, you know, it may be fun if you're just a person in the public to be throwing things that you love on Instagram, but remember you're involving the copyrights of other people, so you need to be protective and respectful of that as well. So there's the issue of how to digitally display, virtually display art online, whether we're doing it at POBA or whether the general public is doing this in social media. It's great that we're sharing things, but we also have a responsibility when we share. So that's number one. Number two, the public concierge services. We offer a number of tips and have done a lot of writing on copyright and how this applies to various fields, and those are available as free tips. But for those people that have serious concerns or questions, that would be something that would come through our concierge department, because there is this issue, and I don't think many people understand, that there's a difference between owning a painting and owning the copyright. And this is something that I think artists need to be educated on so that they know what rights they're giving away and what rights that they're preserving. And this is especially important in the contracts that they're entering into with their galleries or with others. Then there's also this kind of fascinating area that many artists are not aware of that was introduced in the revisions to the Copyright Act in 1976, which basically gave and continue to give artists and their heirs rights to recapture copyright and to renegotiate the terms of licensing agreements that they may have given in the past after a certain number of years. And this is an important area to be educated on, because you only, when that time period elapses from the time of creation to the time that the reversion is possible, you only have then 5 years to do the paperwork and to notify these people. And it gives you really an ability, the artists or their heirs, an ability to renegotiate the original deals. Now, this is going to be certainly very important when reproduction rights have been granted, when printing rights have been granted. So this is a whole area that artists should be aware of. And, you know, if, in fact, there's a collection of copyrights that are reverting or need to be protected, we actually work with some of the best and brightest in this area, and we're happy to, you know, refer on to people that can actually do the work with the individual artist. So we can help not only kind of educate about copyright, I wouldn't say that we would enforce, but we can actually help identify the people who can help do that, either to get the rights back or to renegotiate rights. And then there's the other issue of copyright, which is how do we preserve it in this world where everyone thinks that everything that they see and can take a picture of is somehow their property to then distribute.
Well, and some of that was sort of going to be my next question. You know, we have been discussing the legal side of art ownership a bit on the podcast and plan to continue doing that and inviting guests on. Now, we've also scheduled one of our Business Accelerator workshop courses about precisely this set of issues so that we can help artists really drill down into what they should be protecting and how to protect that and how that needs to be specified early on in their contracts and negotiations. But I'm curious, let's take the heir of a visual artist, somebody who's not themselves an artist, but they may have inherited the copyright of a given piece. So how does the heir know what rights they actually own in the first place and what rights are transferable? Do you have any insights into this category, or how can they protect the copyright if it wasn't assigned in a will explicitly?
Well, you know, I don't want to pretend to be a lawyer, even though I'm a daughter of one. The copyright is closed to the heirs. If it's not specifically written into a will, it's part of the residuary rights. So it would flow to the heirs in the same proportion that every other aspect of the residuary of the estate would. So anything that's not a directed gift would then go to the natural heirs. the copyright, even if it wasn't named, would flow to those people. So that would be part one. Part two is, this is why it's so important to have a sense of date of creation of a work established, if possible, by the artist himself during his life, because copyright has a term. So that's important, and that's why it's also important to have whatever dates of contracts that might have involved that work and any residual, any subsidiary rights, the rights to reproduce, the rights to post. Could be as simple as a gallery having a right to do a catalog for a show, to having the right to do postcards. Having a sense of what the dates of those contracts are is essential now for heirs, because it gives them an ability, if they want, to recapture those rights, even if they've been granted away, and to renegotiate the rates. But all of that, the ability to, you know, copyright is simply the ability to copy. And, you know, outside of fair use, which I don't think would pertain to the visual arts in the same way as it pertains to other arts, these you know, are a bundle of rights that are inextricably linked and belong to the heirs of the estate. The only exception, of course, is if something was done as a work for hire.
Right. Of course, bespoke work is a little bit different. Let me ask you then, I have two more questions. So let me ask you penultimately about sort of shared legacy management. I'm trying to determine if that's something that you do. So what do you do, for instance, if with an heir, let's say a museum wants to make derivative reproductions of the work, of the legacy. So they want to make mugs and t-shirts out of your aunt's quilt designs or sculptures or paintings. Does POBA take on that role of telling them yes or no and sort of managing that, doing some of the legacy management, sharing the relationship with the communications and vetting of proposals, etc.? Or is that utterly the heir's responsibility to do that?
Well, no one does anything alone. I mean, certainly heirs have the lawyers that they deal with. They have accountants that they deal with. And we certainly can at POBA get involved. Again, everything is on a case-by-case basis. We can get involved or can find someone who, you know, has a specific expertise with a type of art who can get involved with that. But yes, licensing agreements, all of that is something that can easily be done through POBA. The real issue before one enters into those things is, again, to balance what one thinks the intent of the artist is and be protective of that. That goes back to that, you know, the whole VOCA rights conversation we were having briefly, versus, you know, the appeal of a, you know, commercial entity, commercial exploitation. You know, and I don't use that word with its negative connotation. I mean, sometimes it's a great thing to be sharing art in different forms, as long as you're not undercutting the integrity of the original piece. But yes, I mean, co-managing, advising on licensing agreements, that's certainly something that would come under the POBA concierge services.
Okay, so lastly this, what if an estate brings you the legacy and wants to make money selling the reproductions? Do you help them with that, to create sort of a business model out of it?
Well, we might direct them to people that they can do it through. COVID has just launched its own shop where certain things can be sold, and we basically do it as an accommodation for the artist. There are some opportunities that we've identified with auction houses, with private dealers that we do. I mean, I think there, you know, depending on the size of the collection or what we're dealing with, there may be people that we could connect folks with. But obviously, you know, we're not in the business of starting other businesses. This is a not-for-profit that exists to basically provide resources. But we could certainly try and identify the right resources in each particular situation. We've got one in Vermont where the head of the Vermont Art Council is trying to figure out how to help the owners of a folk artist's park where his work is all displayed. And, you know, how can his prints, how can his woodcuts, how can his work are all being displayed in what is basically now a tourist attraction that brings in 50,000 visitors a year? How do they sustain that over time? And what should they do? Where do they syndicate? What are the limits? I mean, those are things that, you know, that's a massive project, but one that I think POBA's related affiliates would take on.
Wow, this is really great, Jen. A lot of really incredible, useful information. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Jennifer Cohen and POBA, visit POBA.org. That's POBA.org. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund, visit ClarkHulingsFund.org and be sure and listen to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Jen. It's been really great having you.
Thank you, Daniel.